Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you've heard the program before, you know what we're all about. But if you haven't, let me give you a quick run through here. We interview veterans of World War II each and every weekend, and the idea is to preserve their stories for posterity, but more so to honor them for their service, the sacrifices that they made that led to the freedom we enjoy today. And also, maybe along the way, we might learn a thing or two, maybe even be inspired to love our country the way our greatest generation does. A member of that generation is here today, Bill Kimball, 85 years old, lives in Corcoran, California, home of the Corcoran High Panthers. But Bill is not a Panther. He went to high school in Fresno, a high school a lot of people probably haven't heard about before. Bill, tell me what high school you went to.
I went to St. Teresa's High School. It was one of the three small parochial high schools that were consolidated when San Joaquin Memorial was instigated years ago.
And you didn't only go there, you were the student body president and the valedictorian in 1943.
Class of 43. My wife was in the class of 46, the last class at that school.
How about that? So let's see, 43. So you were a senior, and she was a freshman.
That's correct.
All right.
They said I was robbing the cradle.
I guess so. But the proof's in the pudding. We'll get to that a little bit later on. I want to ask you, you graduated in 1943. So I guess it would have been the fall of your junior year when a little something happened out in the Pacific Ocean that kind of changed the world just a little bit. Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Oh, I remember it clearly, yes.
Where were you?
I was a Fresno Bee paper carrier at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an evening paper, but Sunday we delivered it early. I'd finished my route, and I was at the house. I'd been to church. And my district manager named Harvey Drown called and said, we're putting out an extra. And he put me at the corner of Palm and Olive, and I had a stack of Fresno bees about 3 foot thick. you're chuckling, but in those days, it was a way to get the word out.
That's right.
We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have television. We didn't have iPhones. And all we had was AM radio. And on Sunday, everybody would listen to One Man's Family and the news, and that was all there was to it. But a lot of folks went for a drive in their car on Sunday for something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, about three quarters of the cars did not have radios. And so the result of that was the paper that I sold them on the corner of Palm and Olive was their first notification of that attack. So we did do a service, and I spent all afternoon there.
I guess so. Yeah, that would have been the first that a lot of people heard. So you were part of the distribution, the dissemination of this world-changing news.
You bet.
Do you remember what some of the reactions people had were when they got that paper from you?
They were startled.
I bet.
Startled, yes.
When did you first hear it? Did you know before you saw that paper? Had you heard it on the radio?
Yeah, I heard it on the radio, yeah.
Probably on this radio station, I
Absolutely.
Bet.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, we're KMJ fans from way back.
How did it hit you? I mean, obviously you had that job to do and you had to go and get those papers out, but as a kid who's still pretty young, you're a junior in high school, did it shake you up a little bit? Did you make you wonder what your future was?
Made me mad.
Yeah?
Yep. Made America mad.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that is obviously a very memorable situation for you, something you remember clearly today. And that's a pretty interesting distinction, too, to have passed out newspapers. I'm an old paper boy myself. And I never had the opportunity to stand on a street corner and hand out news about Pearl Harbor. How long did it take you before you thought, you know, I might end up doing something about this? You said you were mad.
There was no doubt I was going in.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. They were drafting people and they're putting them into the service of their choice. And I elected to enlist in the Navy because I felt that the Navy had three squares a day and a warm place to sleep, or if your ship got sunk, you had nothing, but I liked those odds. So I enlisted in the Navy.
So you thought about it. You thought, the Navy's going to put me in a better situation than the Army.
That yes,
was
sir.
Your thinking. And so you did that in September of 1943. And
I enlisted 8 days before I was 18. Uh-huh. I enlisted on the 3rd of September, and then I wasn't taken and put into the Navy until after that, but it was 8 days before my birthday, which was September 11th, incidentally.
Well, there's a whole nother story with that. But long before September 11th, 2001, you had plenty of runs with the kind of violence that we saw on that day, or the conflict, certainly, that we saw on that day. So you end up in the Navy. Now, I'm sure you were a tough kid, and I'm sure parochial school was plenty of a challenge for you growing up in Fresno. But was going into the Navy a wake-up call for you? Did they toughen you up in a hurry?
They did. They sent us to San Diego. We went to the Naval Training Center in San Diego, and I didn't have a normal a routine there. I developed a hernia, and I was sent to the Naval Hospital in San Diego and taken out of the normal progression at the Naval
The training center.
Training center, yes. Uh-huh. And after my surgery, I was put into a ward that later I figured out had a bunch of wounded Marines from Tarawa.
Wow.
I wish I'd have realized it at the time. This was in December of 43, and the Gilbert's campaign was in November, and it had to have been a whole ward full of recovering Marines.
Well, all you saw, I'm sure, was guys who were hurt, and you probably figured they got hurt out there somewhere yeah. like I'm going to be headed.
And they would never talk about it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't surprise me all that much. I bet you were mad about that you had the hernia, had to have the operation, and were stuck there.
I was concerned because I was the assignments to Navy schools hadn't been made at our recruit company. And I thought I had missed schools, and it turned out I did. I didn't go to any of the Navy schools.
But by December, in fact, New Year's Eve in 43, they had a ship for you.
Yes, sir, they did. I'd been released from the hospital, went back to the training center, and they put me into a temporary group. And a few days later, they gave me an assignment.
And that assignment was?
To the USS Ashtabula. We were, it's a Navy oiler, nearly 600 feet long,
mm-hmm.
Carried, I've kicked around the numbers and I'm not clear on them, probably about 1 million gallons of black bunker oil, diesel fuel, and aviation gasoline, plus barrels of other lubricants that we carried on deck.
So 600 feet, 1 million gallons, sounds like you're a floating bomb to me.
Well, we were. And people have said, didn't you get worried? Well, yeah, we were worried for about the first 2 days. And you get pragmatic, and you figure that if it's going to go off, it'll probably happen in a hurry, so there's not much to worry about there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just went about doing our work.
Well, it strikes me you had said that you thought about it, and you enlisted in the Navy.
Yes, I did.
Because you felt you'd be in a little safer position than had you gone in the Army. It doesn't sound very safe to be floating on top of 1 million gallons of explosive material.
Well, it wasn't any time. There was no time to change your mind then. I had the duty, and I proceeded with it.
You know, the Ashtabula is a very interesting name. And for those of you at home who are trying to figure out how to spell that, it's Ashtabula. I bet when you first got to that ship and you sailors were trying to figure out how to say it, you probably heard a bunch of different interpretations of that.
We did. Ashta was the nickname, or the Mighty A. We called her the Mighty A.
That sounds a lot easier for some folks. So on the Ashtabula, which you've described very well for us, the details, the specs of the ship, and Bill's pretty good on specs. For decades, he's been working in the pump business on the agricultural side of things here in the San Joaquin Valley. And I say he's been working because he's still working full time at 85 with Kemble Hydrotech there in Corcoran, California.
We sell Peerless pumps, which has just been bought by Grundfos, and we're having fun sorting through the new procedures.
I bet. You've got to learn all over again.
Yes, sir.
But you don't seem to mind one bit. Ready for another challenge?
Pardon?
You're ready for another challenge.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And back in late 1943, early 1944, your challenge was to learn what to do on this oiler, the USS Ashtabula. They made you a radar man? They made you a radar man?
No, they made me a gunner.
All right.
And the rest of that gunner story is from San Pedro to Pearl Harbor, I was so seasick I couldn't eat a meal. That was no fun, a lot of no fun. But I made it known that I wanted to get into something technical. I've been a number nut all of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at my records, and they said they didn't have any place in the radio room, but asked me if I would go into the radar room. And I said, of course. And so I did. And in the radar room, we had a first-class radio technician who had a correspondence course in radio. Mm-hmm. And he asked me if I wanted to take it. Well, I had been studying, so I asked him if I could. And he didn't send the tests in for grading. He graded them right on the ship, and I got some pretty good grades, and so it did help me. And I was soon a third-class radarman.
All right. And so you figured I'll be keeping an eye on the radar, see what's
coming. That's correct. Yes, and I was a radar operator, and actually I proceeded through the ranks, and it was the minimum time. I got second class, and then before the end of the war, I made first class radarman, so I was a first class petty officer.
But between the start of that journey you just described and the end, there were plenty of fireworks in the Pacific, and Bill Kimball's going to attest to that. We're going to take a break here on Hometown Heroes, but when we come back, we'll hear more of Bill's stories aboard the USS Ashtabula. They saw quite a bit of action, including the famous Battle of the Leyte Gulf. You may have heard of that. We'll hear about it from Bill Kimball himself when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 85-year-old Bill Kimball of Corcoran, California. You may have heard me say he still works full-time, and as we sit here doing the interview, he's got his Bluetooth on, so he means business. He is a businessman through and through. He's also a World War II veteran who has gone around speaking from time to time at different groups. Maybe you've heard him speak. He's also wearing his USS Ashtabula AO-51 polo shirt today, and that's a pretty good-looking belt buckle you got there, too.
It is.
Was that Kings County Homecoming?
Yes, I was Grand Marshal of the King County Homecoming in 2009.
Well, hey, and you got the belt buckle to prove it. Looks good. So we're talking to Bill Kimball about times long ago. He grew up in Fresno after being born in Southern California. He was the valedictorian at St. Teresa's High School in 1943, then enlisted in the Navy. And you said you enlisted in the Navy. You thought that was the safe way to go. You were going to feel plenty comfortable. Then you're on an oiler ship that's got a million gallons of different explosive liquids. And then, to top it off, all the way across your journey to Pearl Harbor, you're seasick?
Absolutely.
Did you ever think, maybe I made the wrong decision in getting in the Navy?
I was convinced of it by the time we got to Pearl Harbor. Yes.
What eventually changed that for you? How did you finally get your sea legs?
Actually, we pulled into Pearl Harbor, and the ship quit rocking, and I got over the physical nausea. Mm-hmm. And would you believe that I never had another queasy moment for the entire nearly 3 years I was aboard that ship? And we were in water a lot rougher than we just experienced. So something happened in my inner ear, or the magic worked, and I got my sea legs.
I guess so. You did get your sea legs. You'd been trained as a radar man, but one of the other things you brought with you today is a big shell casing. That I suppose is from one of the guns.
Yes, it was from the gun I served on when I first went aboard.
So how did that happen? How did you get stuck on a gun?
They were assigning people to slots they needed, and they needed an assistant loader on a 3-inch gun on the Ashtabula, and that's where I found myself.
Now, is that something that you'd had training for before you got on the ship?
No training whatsoever, but it doesn't take much skill to take these shells out of the cabinet and hand them to the loader. That was my job.
Doesn't take a lot of skill, but it does take a little strength, because those are some pretty heavy shells. We're not talking about something you stick in a shotgun.
No, they weighed 75 or 80 pounds, something like that. But I'm sure glad we didn't have to fire in anger during that trip when I was on the gun, because I would have been no help at all.
Well, you did see plenty of action eventually. The Marshall Island invasion in February of 1944, I guess, would be your first taste of combat?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, actually, it was a fueling assignment, and that was our mission. We carried the fuel to the fighting fleet so that they didn't have to come into port to fuel up. And the fueling procedure was that we would get on a course at a slow speed, and then the ships would approach us. On the port side or the left side, one major ship, a cruiser, a carrier, or a battleship would come up on the left side, and they would take several hours to fuel. And on the right side, the starboard side, we had two stations that would accept either a destroyer escort or destroyer, and those ships fueled fairly quickly, and we would have them going and coming all day long. Mm-hmm. But we would spend from first light till dark fueling, when we were on the fueling line, fueling those ships. And my fueling station was the bridge-to-bridge sound power phones, and that was for the purpose of the two commanding officers communicating on course and speed and the official operations. But most of the time, the other talker and I just had a pleasant conversation.
Well, and I imagine that that was no small luxury at the time, because when you're on this ship, you're kind of isolated to the guys that you're serving with.
Absolutely. It's not a prison, but it's just like a prison, because where are you going to go?
So when you had this bridge-to-bridge communication, that's kind of like your line to the outside world, huh?
Oh, it's sort of, yeah. Yeah, you could call it that.
What kind of things would you guys talk about?
Oh, home and girls and and where he'd been and what he'd been doing. One notable day, it wasn't at the Marshall Islands, it was later, we had a carrier alongside, and our course was into the wind, and we had the old propeller airplanes, but the wind was strong enough, they held air ops during the refueling cycle. Mm. And we were about 50 or 75 feet beside them, and we had the perfect viewing sight to watch those air ops, and I was fascinated by that. In fact, I later learned to fly because of, well, that and a fascination with flying.
Well, we'll have to get to that part of the story, too. And you're describing your mission as the Ashtabula being an oiler, a refueling ship to handle all these ships that couldn't go back into port to get fueled. It makes me think, first of all, you're highly explosive because of the cargo you're carrying. And then second, you were probably a pretty good target for the enemy. When you think about World War II in general, people with even a basic knowledge know that part of the Americans' victory in the European theater was cutting off Hitler's supply lines. The success of the Allied forces was their great supply line with the Red Ball Express and all that. And in the Pacific, in the naval battle, obviously keeping that supply line together was crucial. And if the Japanese could take out a ship like yours, they could prevent a lot of other ships from doing their part.
It would have been to their distinct benefit.
Did that occur to you guys at the time?
Well, we always feared it, but after the war, I found out that the Japanese submarine fleet was pretty ineffectual. They before they got very long in the war, they had to use their submarines to supply their far off garrisons, and didn't have them available to attack us. And the way we were attacking them tremendously, and I've got a lot of stories about submarines, and I'm fascinated by those guys. Are tremendous. They are heroes,
no doubt. We've had some of them on this show, and the losses that the U.S. submarine force produced were just
they lost 52 submarines in the war.
But the losses they produced on the other side were incredible.
On the other side, it's terrible.
Well, you weren't on a submarine. You were on the USS Ashtabula. And Bill is very proud of that, as we're going to find out by the time this program's over. Tell me about that first taste of combat, though. I mean, you're a young man. You're less than a year out of high school here in February of 1944, and here you are in a war. What was that like, the first glimpse you got of true naval combat?
Paul, the Marshall's campaign for us was a routine fueling assignment.
Mm-hmm.
An oiler has no more business in a naval battle than grandmother has in a barroom brawl. So they didn't vector us into those hazardous areas.
Right.
But we fueled the ships. We did our duty, and that was our participation in nearly all of the campaigns.
Nearly all of them. Notice he didn't say all of them, because at one point there would be a very close call for the Ashtabula. Throughout this time, did you guys on the ship have much of a clue as to what was going on around you, and the bigger picture of progress in the Pacific?
We had sketches of it, only what was published in the press.
Mm-hmm.
We had our radio people copied the press releases, and they printed them up for us and circulated them on the ships. None of the classified stuff was disseminated to us, and we didn't need to know that stuff.
Sure. So you were part of the Marshall Islands campaign in 1944 and kept going. Plenty more battles that people have heard of, like the Philippine Sea, the Battle of the Leyte Gulf, eventually the invasion of Okinawa, bombarding Japan. And you were still out there when they dropped the bombs in August of 1945.
Yes, sir.
Throughout all that time, did you find yourself growing up, so to speak? Did this change you as a person to be out there through all of that?
I think it did.
How so?
Well, I in studying this correspondence course, I was able to achieve a position of authority, or at least they trusted my judgment. I guess that's the way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
They trusted my judgment, and that I felt was a growing up syndrome.
Absolutely, and since you guys were in the position that you were in, I guess at that point, you probably didn't have to face the reality of war in terms of friends on your ship dying. But you did have to deal with loss. Now, I quote the number all the time, 400,000 Americans died in World War II, more than 400,000.
Yes.
And two of those 400,000 were people that you had a connection with. Tell me about that.
Well, it's ironic. I've told you that I was assigned to my ship on the 31st of December of 1943.
Mm-hmm.
5 days before that, when we invaded New Britain Island at Cape Gloucester, the 1st Marine Division went ashore there on the 26th of December. Well, they had Navy ships supporting that invasion, and one of them was a destroyer that I call him, it's a cousin by choice. His name was Danny Lynch, my first cousin's wife's brother. Mm-hmm. Cousin by choice, if you will.
Gotcha.
But he was a fireman on that ship, and that ship took two 500-pound Japanese bombs, and the destroyer folded up like a jackknife.
Mm.
And he was a fireman, and he was below decks, and he was one of the 108 people that didn't survive that attack. So we lost Danny then, and then 5 days later, I caught the Ashtabula, and then on the 20th of January, a first cousin, James H., we call him Buzz. He and his dad were both James, so his nickname was Buzz.
Mm-hmm.
Buzz was on a B-26. They left Florida, headed for the Azores, and he simply just didn't get there.
Mm.
And his mother, it was a tremendous shock to his mother.
What about for you? When did you get the news of both of those situations, and how did it affect you in terms of what you were doing and how you looked forward from there?
Actually, it was quite a while before the news got communicated to me. My mother wrote me letters and told me we lost Danny and then we lost Buzz, and it was so far in the past that it really didn't have a tremendous impact on me, although I did grieve for them.
I guess I'm a little curious if it solidified your resolve, or not that you needed to be convinced more of what you were doing or how badly you wanted to do what you were doing, but if it made you even more say, we need to win this war.
Oh, yes, of course.
And I sense, too, that this even brings up some emotions now.
Yes, it does.
Thinking back on their deaths.
Yeah. I'm an emotional person, and I have trouble talking about some of these things, some of the time.
Well, I appreciate your courage in talking about them here today. And I get the sense, too, that in looking back now, as you can, after the life that you've had and still working full-time at 85 and all the things that you've been able to do, that maybe there's a part of you that says, you think of Danny, you think of Buzz, that could have been you.
Absolutely. There were 10 of us in our extended family, and we lost those two. Could have been any one of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you have a lot to be thankful for, and I'm thankful that Bill is here with us today. We're going to take another break. When we come back, we'll talk about that close call that the Ashtabula experienced. And if you go to our website, kmjnow.com, you can even see an artist rendering of that has a pretty interesting story in itself. Bill Kemble, 85 years old, at Corcoran, California, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I hope you're having as much fun as I am today visiting with Bill Kemble. He's 85 years old. He still works full-time. Maybe if you're in the agricultural industry, you've dealt with Kemble Hydrotech. You probably dealt with Bill, and you probably know about his big smile and the pride he has in being a Navy man. Served on the USS Ashtabula during World War II. That was an oiler tasked with refueling ships of the U.S. Navy in the Pacific. And in October of 1944, you ended up, Bill, getting maybe a little closer than you'd like to what some people call the largest naval battle in history, the Battle of the Leyte Gulf.
Yes, we did.
Did you have any idea what you were in for when you headed that way?
Have no idea whatsoever. No. No, they needed fuel and ammunition in Leyte Gulf, and another oiler and us and two ammunition ships were assigned to go in there and be the duty suppliers of those products. And we went in there, and within 24 hours of when we went in there, we were the subject of a successful torpedo attack by a Japanese Zero. And we claim we shot down the Zero. In fact, in that painting, you'll see that the attacking ship is afire. Mm-hmm. Now, that's editorialized. we do claim that, though, that being one of the only tankers that shot down Jap planes, and we had two Jap flags on our bridge attesting to that. After the war, they reduced that to one, but it was still a successful attack on those Jap planes, and so we
exactly, because that wasn't necessarily expected of you.
No.
To be an aggressive force or to do any damage against the enemy. You were just there to refuel. And he mentions this painting that I do have posted at kmjnow.com, so I hope you'll take a look at that. Now, I've got to ask you, before we get the whole story of that incident from start to finish, one of the other things that historians note about the Battle of the Leyte Gulf, aside from its sheer magnitude and how huge it was in terms of ships involved and artillery fired, that was the first major battle that the Japanese employed the use of kamikazes here in October of 1944. Did you see any of that, or was there any thought in your guys' minds that that was a possibility?
We knew that we were in harm's way in the Leyte Gulf, mm-hmm. and the night after we took that torpedo was the night that Admiral Kincaid crossed the T at Surigao Straits. We watched that battle on the horizon, and I watched it on the radar. And it's an irony, but one of the largest battleships ever built, the Musashi, we were hit at about 6:45 in the evening local time, and the Musashi, which was nearly a thousand foot long, one of the two biggest battleships ever built, we sank her. So I didn't know it at the time, but it was ironic that within an hour we did achieve that success.
And when you say we, you just mean the 3rd and the 7th Fleets working together.
That's
in this
correct,
battle,
yeah.
Not necessarily the Ashtabula.
Well, the Kurita force was coming in from the north, and our carrier air found them early that day.
Mm-hmm.
And they spent all day long from several groups sending attacks in. And they, by luck of the draw, they started hitting Musashi. And the story goes that she took 19 500-pound bombs on deck and suffered 19 aerial torpedo hits below the waterline and just suffered more damage than she could handle.
And this was, I mean, in terms of the Navy war in the Pacific, a lot of people see the Battle of the Leyte Gulf kind of like in Europe they would see the Battle of the Bulge. This was kind of a last gasp effort by the Japanese.
As a matter of fact, after the Battle of Leyte Gulf, the Japanese Navy was not a major force.
They pretty much threw everything they had left at you there.
They did, and after that, they had naval units at Singapore where they had fuel and no supplies and no food, and they had the rest of them were in the inland sea in Japan where they had food and supplies but no fuel.
So you guys, as the Ashtabula, as being the oiler that you were, had been around there knowing that you're going to have to fuel all these different ships that are going to be participating in the battle. When, on that October 24th evening that you talked about, was that something where there had been action all around you and then this plane got you?
No. We had a quiet afternoon, as a matter of fact.
And where were you?
I was at the air search radar when the torpedo hit.
And I want to ask you about that, too. And we'll get back to this October 24th evening. But you mentioned watching this huge battle on radar.
Yes.
I don't think too many of us have ever watched a battle unfold in real time on radar. What did that look like? What are you looking for on that radar readout? And I imagine you've got, what, a few-inch diameter circle to look at?
No, no, no. It was about an 8-inch diameter circle.
All right.
Yeah, they call it a planned position indicator. It was used mainly for navigation.
Mm-hmm.
The air search radar was a different kind of presentation, but the surface search was, it's like looking at a map.
Uh-huh.
The boundaries of the island showed, and the ship showed as light spots. You see it unfold.
So when they are firing at each other, are you seeing?
You couldn't see the shells. No.
Couldn't see the shells, but you see where the ships are
on the wing of the bridge. You could see the lights from the firing.
So you could see it and you could hear it, and on the radar you could tell who was where somewhere.
Yeah, that's correct.
What if a ship sunk? Would you have been able to see that?
We could have, but we didn't know which ones to watch.
We
sank two Japanese battleships in that Surigao Strait action.
But your radar readout doesn't have a little flag on top of the blob to say this is U.S., this is Japan.
No ID on them.
So it wasn't huge on detail, but it was probably exciting for you to have that and have a sense of what was going on.
It was.
So that's where you were when that Japanese plane got your ship.
Mm-hmm.
How did that occur from your standpoint? What did you hear? What did you see? How did you know that you were under attack? Wasn't that hard to figure out?
I was operating the air search radar.
Yep.
I was sitting in a chair, as always. I had a bulkhead about 3 feet behind me, and I was operating it. And when the torpedo hit, it shook our ship like a dog shaking a bone.
Mm-hmm.
Scared us to death. And the ship immediately took a port list,
mm-hmm.
and my chair slid back to the bulkhead behind me.
As you just reenacted here in our studio. Yep.
Several four-letter words were uttered. The only person really hurt in that attack was the electrician's mate whose general quarters station was in the radar room. He was an older fella, and he had two ships shot out from under him in the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And when that torpedo hit, it shattered his nerves. Mm-hmm. And he just went to pieces. We called sick bay, and they took him and put him under medical care, and they transferred him off the ship, and hopefully he obviously had received adequate treatment, but we didn't see him again.
So you'd been on the ship for almost a year, I guess about 10 months at this time?
Yeah.
And never had anything like that occur?
No.
What did that do to you? I mean, you talked about how it impacted him. How about for you? Was it a panic for a while? Give us
No panic, but a fear. Mm-hmm. Fear for your life. And it stayed with us as long as we were in the Gulf. We were at general quarters for about 72 hours from that moment on. And as long as that was in effect, it was fear.
So if you're listening at home and you just heard him say general quarters for 72 hours, I want to make sure that we detail that specifically so you all understand. When you say general quarters for 72 hours.
Your battle station.
Period. No
yes.
Breaks, no rest, no nothing. You're awake, on edge, for 3 days straight.
Ready to, the firing control was condition red, which said anything in the air is enemy, and control green was fire at will.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about the human damage of this attack. What about the damage to the ship?
Well, the damage to the ship, there was a hole, I don't remember the numbers, but a hole about 35 feet in diameter and about 25 or 30 feet deep. As big as a small house, it blew a hole in the ship, and nothing exploded.
And that in itself seems like a minor miracle.
It is. You're looking at a lucky man. I've been lucky all my life, man.
Well, we've been talking about you're on a floating bomb. You've got a million gallons of explosive fuel on your ship. Is that a matter where the spot on the ship that torpedo hit determined whether if it had hit, say, a spot further down, further ahead, or further aft?
If it had been further aft, it had hit the engine room and we'd have gone down. If it had hit further forward, it could have hit a fuel tank where it was explosive and we could have gone down. No, they hit the right spot for us as long as they had to hit us.
And you, and when did you find out that one of your guys, topside, had hit them, the plane that dropped the torpedo?
Well, we knew it right away.
Was that the cause of some celebration?
We had the sound power phones. We were on the circuit where we could talk to the gunners. Actually, our duty, we didn't have fire control radar, so our duty was to, the radar duty was to tell the people on the guns where the enemy was and the direction and whether he was closing or opening.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of those kinds of contacts that we relayed to them, and then when they shot down the plane, we knew it right away. See, we were in a closed room. We didn't have any windows, but we could go out on the wing of the bridge during breaks.
So had you been giving those signals to them as this plane was approaching? Had you seen it on radar?
No, we didn't see that plane. He came from over the island, Samar Island.
Uh-huh.
And we were only about 2 miles from the island, and he closed that distance quick.
So he had been shielded by the landmass and then snuck
in.
I know that it's your life, and so you describe it because you've been through it. But I think for those of us who didn't live through it and trying to piece together just how incredible this is, this torpedo puts a 35 by 30 hole or so in the side of your ship. No one's killed?
No.
And it could have blown the thing to smithereens.
Yep.
But it hit the right spot to protect you. So I'm just thinking about this and how you guys might have reacted. Most of the time when I talk to a Navy veteran whose ship was hit, it was a devastating situation. In this case, no one's killed. They don't set off all this explosive material on your ship. You guys are all right. Was it a cause for celebration?
No, certainly it wasn't. No, we were frightened for sure.
Yeah.
And I told you the ship listed. We listed 12 degrees to port. And within 2 hours, the officer and the crew that took care of the fuel in the tanks mm-hmm. had shifted the balance of the ship to where we were righted, and we went on about our business.
That's incredible to me. Do you remember when you first saw the damage, when you got to go out and see the hole that had been left in your ship?
You wondered how the hell we ever stayed afloat.
I bet. That's what I thought you'd say. Yeah. Unbelievable. Well, and again, if you want to see an artist's rendering of that attack on the Ashtabula, October 24th, 1944, as well as a picture of Bill these days and maybe some from the past as well, you can go to our website, kmjnow.com, or check out Hometown Heroes on Facebook. And we'll be back with the rest of the program. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
That is none other than our guest today, Bill Kimble, bringing us back with his harmonic stylings on what some may call the mouth harp. 85 years old, a proud Navy veteran of World War II, served on the USS Ashtabula, and he described that close call that his oiler ship had on October 24th, 1944. But there's more of this story to cover. You were still out there in 1945, all the way till the end of the war in the Pacific, Bill. And I understand that one of the things that you have specific memories of is the day in mid-April of 1945 that President Franklin D. Roosevelt died. What do you remember about that day and how that news spread around your ship?
Well, the news came in on the radio. Franklin D. Roosevelt, we seemed like he was a friend of ours, and it was a terrible loss. And I saw emotions coming out of a couple of crusty old chiefs that you didn't think ever had an emotion in their lives. They were weeping.
Mm-hmm.
He was their boy. It was terrible. We didn't know who Harry Truman was, but turned out we approved of what Harry Truman did, especially with making the decision to drop that big bomb on those big bombs, the two of them,
mm-hmm.
because we thought that was a pretty good idea. You know why? Because after those bombs got dropped and the Japanese quit, we all knew we were going home.
Exactly. And we've talked so many times on this show about that, the number of lives that were saved, even as lives, of course, were cost by that decision that Harry Truman made, a decision that he had no idea he would have to make.
That's right.
He didn't know about the bomb.
He didn't even know about the bomb when he became president.
That's right.
They went in and said, Mr. President, we need to tell you about this.
Surprise, surprise.
That's right.
And thankfully, he made that decision that he did. Now, and when those bombs were dropped, you have a little printout here that you brought with you, and thank you for bringing all these great goodies to help paint the picture, and I'm going to put some pictures online for you at home to get an idea of what I'm talking about. But that diagram shows that, that your ship was only about 800 or 900 miles away.
Just under 900 miles, yes.
It wasn't something that you could see or hear, though.
No, no. In fact, somebody asked me, could you see the plume? And at that distance, I had to tell them, no, we didn't know to look in the first place.
Of course.
And I think it was really too far to see in second.
I think you're right, but I imagine probably it also didn't take too long for you to find out about it.
Oh, no, we knew about it at once. That kind of news traveled fast.
And how was that news received on the ship? Just
same way as the rest of it. They brought it in on the radio. And actually, it passed by word of mouth, but then it was printed in our daily news sheet, too.
You guys started to get pretty excited?
Absolutely.
So you eventually found out that you were coming home. What was that like for you to come back? Because I'm sure there were days, especially October 24th of 44, that you weren't quite sure you'd make it home.
Well, we didn't really give up, but it was always there. Mm-hmm. You always wonder.
When you did get back home, got to see your family again.
Yeah.
What was that like for you?
That was great. It was great. Right after I got back, I purchased an Army surplus Jeep. I'm a first Jeeper from 1946.
Whew.
Well, maybe not the first, but an early one anyhow.
Yeah.
And two friends and I drove it from Fresno to New York and back.
Wow.
Yeah, we visited with service buddies. Mm-hmm. We went to Ely, Minnesota and Allentown, Pennsylvania, and drove down, went into New York from Allentown and drove down Broadway. And then went to Washington, D.C., visited a cousin of mine. The oldest cousin in our group was a gal. But she went in early, and then we drove it home. But that's what I did that summer, and then the fall in September after I was discharged, I enrolled at Fresno State, and 4 years later I had my Bachelor of Science degree in engineering.
GI Bill came in handy for you, huh?
You know something? That GI Bill got me educated. Without it, my life would have been different.
And you've had quite the life. For the last half century or 60 years, really, since you graduated from Fresno State. Bill is a bulldog. His sons who went to Cal Poly might try to argue with him about Central California supremacy, but I'm going to be announcing Bulldog basketball later tonight, so you know where I stand on the idea. I mentioned your sons, two sons and a daughter, and they never would have been born if you didn't come home from the war.
That's right.
Tell me about meeting your wife.
Actually, she invited me to be her date at her prom.
Which was at your alma mater, St. Teresa's?
Yes, yeah, yeah. She was in the last class to graduate from St. Teresa's. The next year, all the students went to Memorial, and she was in a class of 10 girls, and they've been friends for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But our relationship blossomed after that date, and in August of 48, 2 years later, we were married, August the 7th of 48, and. It was the 14th of April last year that I lost her.
Mm-hmm. Two sons and a daughter and two grandchildren. So that's five people that never would have been born if you didn't make it home from the war.
Right.
And I get the sense when you talk about going across the country in a Jeep and all of that, that when you got back from the war, life was probably a little different. You probably wanted to exercise some of that freedom that you'd been fighting for.
That's right. It started out as a lark, but we did make the trip.
And another thing that I mentioned was that you're still working full-time at age 85, and I know the folks in your office are listening today. I know they love working with you. Tell me how you got started in your career. How did you come to be a pump man?
Thank you for asking. When I was a senior at Fresno State, Herb Wheaton, our department head, and Ralph Gurley, a Navy captain, incidentally, and Stan Burleski, those three guys, Charlie Sears. But Herb Wheaton says, why don't you guys go by Peerless and see if they want to hire anybody? And several of us did, and I was the only married one to go down there. And it turned out that the Peerless dealer in Corcoran, Don Wilson was his name, he was looking for a married person, somebody ready to settle down.
Mm-hmm.
And Peerless was looking for some single people, and it turned out they hired several of my classmates, three of them, and I got together with this guy, Don Wilson, and we made the arrangement, and I graduated on the night of June the 12th of 1950 and went on his payroll the next morning. And I've been there ever since, as a matter of fact. Actually, he impressed me an awful lot because the first time I met him, he flew his own plane, and I met him at Chandler Field. And he was a pilot. In fact, later he bought a training airplane, and asked another of his employees and me to go learn to fly in that airplane. Lloyd Couchet was the other guy's name. Hello, fine fella. Red's dead and gone now. But that's how I learned to fly, and I flew my own airplane for 10 years after that.
I think the obvious question I need to ask you, because people hear a lot of guys on this show, and there aren't too many of them who are still working. Why are you still working? What do you get out of it that's so fulfilling and rewarding for
you? Let me tell you. Mm-hmm. I've been given a life's work that I love to do. Mm-hmm. But the Lord's given me the energy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I have my health, I'm going to be there.
And I bet no one tries to talk you out of that either.
Well, they say, when are you going to retire? I said, I'm not going to retire. I'm going out feet first someday.
I like that. Now, I'm sure you could tell us a million stories of your career, of course, dealing with agriculture around the San Joaquin Valley and right there. And just evidence that you're still working, that's all. I'm sure you could tell us a million stories working with people like the Boswell operation right there in Corcoran and people all over the valley.
I've got many California farm families that have trusted us to do their work to the fourth generation. And one special family, the fifth generation, is about 9 years old now.
Wow. And I look at you and your family and the generations that wouldn't have existed if you didn't make it back from World War II. And I have to ask you, Bill, as we approach the end of our program here, why do you go around talking about your experiences in World War II?
Really, I don't go around doing it, but recently a friend of mine asked me to address the Rotary Club in mm-hmm. Corcoran. He's a trade ally and a friend, and I said, sure. And then that read the invitation to come and talk to you, and I'm glad to do that. But, Paul, I want to thank you for your efforts in producing this show and keeping our stories before the folks. We're dying off 1,000 a day, World War II vets.
That's right.
And you're doing a good work, and I want to thank you for it in the name of all the veterans.
Well, thank you, Bill. I promise you I get a lot more out of it than you guys do, and it's my privilege. I want to ask you, and what I was getting at, I guess, with asking about why you go around talking. I know that you're a man of purpose, and that's clear in the work that you continue doing and what you just shared about that. In terms of why you think it's important for your stories to be told, for your generation, for us to understand today what you did and why you did it.
I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the people that oppose our use of the atom bomb, they keep telling us all the little girls that got killed at Hiroshima.
Mm-hmm.
And, Paul, they are dead, and they're not coming back. But, Paul, I would be willing to trade their lives for American lives in a heartbeat. And I make no bones about it. I think the difference between their viewpoint and mine is their lives were on the line when they made their decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the group whose lives were in harm's way.
And it's very possible that those bombs could have saved your life.
Absolutely.
As well as
absolutely, yes.
Millions of others.
You never know. I've had a good life. Things have gone well. I've got granddaughters who are both very bright. I've got an electrical engineering degree out of MIT for one of them. The other one is a class leader at Coronado High School in Colorado Springs. She's carrying a 4.8 grade point average. Whew, doing fine. And my cup runneth over, Paul.
Amen. And I'll say the same, because it's been a privilege to visit with you today, as well as all the other veterans that I get to talk to. Bill, thank you for serving our country, and thanks for telling us a little bit about it. That's Bill Kemble. He's been our guest today. For more about him, go to our website, kmjnow.com. And if you need a pump, I think you know where to find one now. Bill Kemble's your man. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.